A few days ago at a Sunday service, or I think it was Sunday service somewhere, I was talking about why Swamiji has appointed someone to be the spiritual director of Ananda even after he passes. And that appointment has been given to Jyotish, a beautiful, great soul that many of you know. If you don't know him, he'll be speaking in this church on Sunday, on the 19th of April, with his wife, Devi. And Swamiji has expressed the fact that as Ananda becomes a more and more expansive work as the years go on, already we're on three continents and there's thousands of people involved. You know, if there's one individual in charge, you have the great possibility of becoming like the Catholic Church, where that individual tries to have more and more power and more pomp, and in an attempt to make that individual look more and more important, there's more and more gold and more ceremony and more special costumes, so that it's unmistakable that here comes the Pope. And But Swamiji's comment was that the reason that one individual needs to be a certain amount of the focus is not so that that one person can be declared infallible, but so that there will be a living example of the personification of the qualities of the fulfillment of this spiritual path. Because otherwise it's too easy for aberration to set in. And things like institutional ego, even if not personal, but institutional ego can take over. And the qualities of a true devotee of master can become more and more confused. Without, I can speak very highly of Jyotish, and I have, and I will again. But let's simply to say he's worthy of the position, and his wife also. But I was thinking of it in terms of master. A number of years ago, quite a few years ago now, Swamiji started speaking of this path as a ray of the divine. And he was making some effort to communicate to us how it can be both specific and also extremely impersonal in the same way. And he talked about being in tune with the ray, and that this is indeed a specific ray of the divine, but that we do this path a disservice, and we do even our own guru a disservice, if we insist on seeing even the personified example of this path in too personal a way. Because the very nature of the guru and of the avatar is that all personal identification has been eradicated. When someone once spoke of Yogananda, spoke to him about his humility, he answered by saying, "How can there be humility when there is no sense of self?" And then he said, "I killed Yogananda long ago. No one dwells in this temple now but God." And yet, if we think only abstractly, without some focal point for our devotion, without some living example to personify and exemplify for us what it really means to be a devotee devoted to this particular ray, then we're too much subject to our own imagination. And so Master came, Yogananda came, and he inhabited a physical body, and he assumed, as he described it, he said himself, Swami writes in the path, "When I see the personality, I have to assume," Master writes about incarnating, he said, "at first it feels kind of heavy and itchy, like a big overcoat on a hot day." He said, "but then I get used to it and I don't feel it confining me anymore." Can you imagine? Well, we can only imagine. You know, just having such freedom that to come into one body and assume one personality just feels like being wrapped up in heavy wool like that. Master Swami talks about toward the end of his life, when he was working on his Bhagavad Gita commentary and Swamiji was with him, that they would take a walk out in the garden in the evening, And sometimes Master would hold on to Swami's arm, and sometimes he would stumble as he walked. And he said to Swamiji, "I'm in so many bodies, sometimes I forget which one I'm supposed to keep going." What a marvelous state of freedom, isn't it? That most of us are so certain about who we are and what we're doing. But imagine being so expanded in our consciousness that as Ananda Moyi Ma said, I have to ask people whether or not I've eaten. Because I don't know whether this body has been fed. All the bodies have been fed. I can't really tell whether this one has been fed. It's such a blissful state. When I wrote in my book about Swami, this was an incident that happened many years ago. We went to Disneyland. Swamiji used to like to go to Disneyland. More recently, meaning in the last 15 or 20 years, when Walt Disney was alive, he protected it, and it was very innocent and very pure. Now it's much more commercialized, and much more of the popular culture has invaded it. And Swamiji stopped enjoying it. But there was a time when it was really a fantasy land. And we were there, and it was the evening, it was time for the electric parade when all the characters come down Main Street all dressed in lights, which is just really beautiful. And we were staking out our place on the sidewalk. There were about 20 of us. And Swamiji got very inward, and he looked at all of these hundreds, even thousands of people within our view, and he said, "Imagine being every one of these people." He said, not merely loving them or having a sense of kinship, but consciously aware of the fact that we are every one of these beings. He said that was Master's state of consciousness. And the thought was so moving to all of us, and Swami's bhav, Swami's spiritual mood itself was so elevated that we all sat down on the sidewalk right there in Disneyland and meditated. We meditated, I think, almost an hour. And when we finally sort of came out, because the parade was coming down, this whole crowd of people had formed around us, and we were just this weird meditating group in the middle. We just stood up at that point. But you know, there's no point at which this divine is not present. And now, thinking about the words we heard in Autobiography of a Yogi and this idea of communities, it's a very interesting fact when you read the New Testament, when you read the Acts of the Apostles after Jesus died. One of the first things that those disciples of Christ did was they formed themselves into cooperative intentional communities. When I sort of read that, I said, Swamiji, look what they did. The first thing they did was they made communities. It was, I spoke to an Episcopal friend of mine, and the explanation he gave me was that they all thought the world was about to end, so they were getting together for the end of the world. But quite frankly, I think that's an imposition later. Because all that idea about the world ending, Jesus was an avatar. He knew it wasn't going to end. He couldn't have told his disciples that the end of the world was coming, because it wasn't. And the end of the ego was coming, if they were lucky. But he had them band together because they were trying to do something entirely new in an atmosphere that was not at all supportive to it. It was Dwapara Yuga, the Kali Yuga descending. They were Jewish disciples who had committed themselves so deeply to this particular path, and then Paul took the path out of Judaism and started saying you could be a follower of this Jewish rabbi, which was Jesus, without actually following the ritual prescriptions of Judaism. And there was this huge conflict in the Jewish faith about whether or not you could be a follower of Christ and not be a Jew, not be circumcised and converted, but just go directly and have salvation. In other words, it was not a congenial atmosphere, and they were under the Roman rule. So naturally, Jesus' advice to them was, band together, you of like mind, and stick together. How are you ever going to hold to this with the whole world going in another direction? It's common sense, really. Well, this is where we find ourselves now. We're in Dwapara Yuga ascending, so it's not quite as grim as it was at the time of Christ. I mean, what they finally did is those who were sincere just went out into the desert. The desert fathers were founded because it was Kali Yuga descending. I mean, what is the point? We're not going to be able to get this society going anywhere. Let's just sit this one out until it's over. You know, But we're Dwapara ascending. This is the good news, and this is also the bad news, because that means we have a job to do here. And what is the, what did Master say? We don't have any words of Master speaking about cooperative communities. Not that they're not recorded, but they're not released. They're not, they're owned and they're by others, and they're not in our hands. But Swamiji said, Master, at virtually every public talk that Swamiji heard in the last 3.5 years of Master's life, he would urge people to band together, ye of like mind, simple God-centered living. But you see, he also writes an autobiography of a yogi, and Swamiji writes in The Path about the same subject. It isn't just that everybody will get to live there. It's that society has to be led from a certain level. And when people see that something is possible, especially something, a powerful idea is possible, then the effect of that comes out like rain. And many people at great distance from it still are guided and take hope from that possibility, or have the opportunity to drop into that reality, or it disperses as the idea of community disperses through a spiritual family like this one. And even though not everyone actually has everything in one place, nonetheless, the core of that committed energy goes out and gives everyone a lifeline of light. And we're in this extraordinary historical moment, which Master talked about from 50 years ago. 1952, he passed away. But he declared repeatedly, again, Swamiji tells us this from Swamiji's own experience of listening to him speak, he declared repeatedly that a great change was coming. And Master talked about that change as not being an easy change. The world would transition, especially America, would transition with difficulty. But we were transitioning out of the remnants of this Kali Yuga energy, this commitment to matter as the primary reality, which when Kali Yuga ending and Dwapara beginning, what's happened is we've become intensely frantic about matter, is what we've done. We haven't yet transcended it. We're just applying more and more energy to it. You know, more and more things, more and more expensive cars and shoes and bigger houses and, you know, mega mansions and huge amounts of money. And even the little people who don't have much, you know, still have a great deal. I mean, in this country, poverty is perhaps only having one television. And I don't mean, I'm not talking about people who are really, really poor, but poor in undeveloped countries, you know, is really poor. It's really a different reality. So the wealth of this country has been the result of our good karma and our hard work and our creativity and our freedom and our governmental system. It's not like it's undeserved, but it's gotten a little twisted. And you know, and what we see now is the beginning of the consequences of that twist, and whether or not there'll be another sort of rise before there'll be a bigger fall, I'm not a prophet, I don't know. But Master promised us that the world was going to change. And there was going to be conflagration, there was going to be earth change, there was going to be financial change, and all of it for one reason, so that the power of spirit can ascend. So that simple living, plain living and high thinking, self-realization, a rededication to God. This country was founded out of dedication to God. And now all of that has been corrupted in so many ways. And Master says this country needs to come back to its roots. And it will come back to its roots because of its good karma, but not without some difficulty. So we're going to be living through, maybe tomorrow, maybe next year, maybe in a few years, I don't know, but soon. We're going to be living through this dual reality. And on one level, it's self-realization, and all that that represents, and I don't just mean Ananda in this path, but the ray of self-realization, the understanding that spirit dwells within, the understanding that we are all manifestations of God, and that's not just here, but just like Master says, my Philippines, my England, my Africa, such a person who has that attitude will never lack for creative scope for service. Such a sweet way to put it, isn't it? But that attitude is very, very strong. At the same time, there's this other force that is my country and not yours, my religion and not yours, my culture and not yours. You know, it's like it's, well, it's schizophrenic is what it really is. You know, you have this rising global spiritual consciousness and you have this other dark force and they're just fighting like this. And we, who are part of this rising light force, just have to focus off on the far horizon where we see that sun coming up. You know, I'm sure many of you have been in some beautiful natural setting and watched that sun come up. Some of us have been out on the Ganges in Varanasi at dawn. We get up really early from our hotel and we go down and we get in these boats and they take these boats out into the middle of the Ganges. And if there's not a fog on the river, which sometimes there isn't, many times there isn't, you're just sitting in the middle of the Ganges and you look over to the bank. All of Varanasi is on one side of the river. The other side supposedly is cursed. I mean, people say that it floods on that side, but the real reason is that it's cursed. That's what I believe too. So the whole city's on one side. The other side is just sand. And you're sitting in the boat, you look on the sandy side, and you see this little half circle of that brilliant orange color that the sun can be. And the tradition is everybody faces the sun, and we do the Gayatri Mantra together. Everybody says the Gayatri Mantra. What is the beginning of the Gayatri Mantra? Bhuvaha Swaha Om, and etc. I can't remember it, and I'm standing here now. But we all say the mantra together, and this enormous orange ball of light rises up over that river. I mean, as you can imagine, it's thrilling, and we're all holding little candle boats, and we say prayers and let them go into the river, and we watch the little candle boats go down the river. That's where we are. This big orange sun is rising over this open plain of possibilities, and behind us is this big other thing going on. And we have to hold to this. And whether we hold to it because you move to community and you serve that community or whatever it is, or you just live wherever you're living right now, you have to hold to it very deep in your heart. And understanding that holding to it is a moment-by-moment reality, much more than anybody realizes. The whole destiny of the planet, what to speak of our own destiny, is determined by every little turn of consciousness. You know, every little turn of consciousness is the accumulated force which makes the vibrations of this planet. And Master says the dissonant human vibrations create bad weather, diseases, earthquakes, tornadoes, what to speak of depressions and wars. And we fight that with light. We fight that within every moment that we can be conscious enough to do it, which is the battle. Is we fight it with a constant awareness of the divine. It's not enough to be good people. We have to be pious people. It's the rededication to God that's what's being asked of us as a nation. You know, we were founded for God, and we must rededicate ourselves to God. What does that mean? That means to light, to the divine sound of Om. That means to joy, to love, to self-offering, nothing less than that. And in the moment when we think we're so impatient about something that we start getting like anxious like this, that's the moment we have to say, no, you know, I live for God. This world is dissonant in so many directions. It needs my calm and loving thought right now. It needs my example of goodness. It needs my example of courage in the face of difficulty. It doesn't have to be anything big and dramatic. Nobody needs to know what you're doing. But you know, and God knows. There's, in the song that we sang at the beginning, I laughed because these are the two like male-oriented songs, Brothers and Walk Like a Man, which used to get us in a lot of trouble at Ananda. Things have calmed down a little bit on those issues, but I was actually realizing it has to be walk like a man. Well, for one thing, men walk different than women, but it has to be walk like a man because what it's about is that very impersonal dedication to principle and calm disregard of self. I mean, women can be masculine in that respect, but the feminine energy is different than that. And yes, the feminine is required, but there's also in this time and place something else which is needed, which is we really have to walk like a man. We have to be able to not be concerned about what might be going on around us. And this is a long rhythm I'm talking about. I mean, Master put it differently. You don't know what a terrible cataclysm is coming, he said. I'm saying there's going to be a little bit of dissonance around us. You know, we each speak from what we can see. That's how much I can see. And then we have to have our consciousness there. And what is that? That's the spiritual eye, that's eyes slightly lifted up. When we put this temple together, when it became ours, I mean, in the back, there's a picture hanging, which is, from my point of view, just a little bit higher, and I see Swamiji and I see Master, so that whenever I look out at all of you, I also see them. And that's how we have to live. You know, we have to sort of put right here, you know, the spiritual eye, Master's face, Master's ray, however you define it, it really, who cares what the words are? You know, they don't care. But we have to make it clear to ourselves. We can't say, oh, it doesn't matter. It matters because it has to be clear to us. And if we can take, you know, this beautiful consciousness behind us, personified, and put it right here, so that whatever else is happening in the world, we're undeterred in our movement toward that, no matter how it is like this. You know? This is why Master said, band together, those of you who share high ideals. And whether we band together physically, which many of us have, or band together in sanghas, which many of us have, or band together because there's just rays of light going out in all directions, you know, cling to that. Many years ago, after I had done a great deal of work, a big project, what was it? It's probably publishing The Path the first time. I went to visit my parents in Southern California, and I'm not exactly sure why this happened, but I got very sick, which I rarely do, and I got a very high fever, and I was down there for about 4 or 5 days longer than I'd intended because I was too sick to go back to Ananda. I've had such a high fever that I lay in bed for I don't know how long, curled up in the fetal position, convinced that if I uncurled like this, that my body would split in 4 pieces. Brain. And after a long time of that, I guess my fever started going down. I started thinking, you know, there's been lots of time in my life when I haven't been curled up like this and I haven't gone into 4 pieces. And very tentatively, I stretched out like this, you know, but the brain was really addled. And then afterwards, when I was well enough to sit on the couch with my parents and watch television, I sort of had this realization of how easily I could just say to my parents, oh, I think I won't go back to Ananda. I'll just stay here and get a job. It would seem like the most reasonable statement to them. In fact, they would probably cheer, you know, like, great. Not that they were really against it, but they wouldn't have minded if I'd left. And I could feel like there was a little thread of light from me. And of course, if I'd made that decision, my friends at Ananda would have just, you know, they would have sent a little army down there to find out what had happened to me. But I could feel this thread of light coming right out of my heart. And it went like through the ether, and then it came down at Ananda Village, you know, to my little trailer where I was living by myself at that time. And I could just feel it, I guess because my mind, I was addled, you know, like this. And I could see that there were demons, and they were holding onto it, and they were bouncing on it, trying to break it like that. It was very, very vivid, and I think actually very true in apocryphal, if not literal, way, that there's these bands of light that tie us. There's a band of light from the gurus to us, from the altar to us, from Swamiji to us. And you know, and there will be demons who will bounce on it, and we have to constantly project that light out. Whatever else is going on, just hold that. Birth, death, success, failure, health, disease, doesn't matter. You see, this light transcends all of them. You know, one wonderful thing to think about is once you're in the astral world, it's all gone. No matter how intensely real it is, as soon as you're gone, you're gone. Because it's just a role we play. It's very interesting while it's happening, you know, and totally absorbing. But as soon as we step back from it, it's just gone. And we just have to live in that. That's the band of light. That's the picture here. Just live in that. Project that. Rededicate ourselves, you know, on behalf of our whole country and on behalf of our planet, to this ideal of united spirit. We're not brothers and sisters, Master said, until we unite in God. Human relationships dissolve, but if we are united in God, it goes on infinitely.